Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sir Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We have two Greatest Britons for you today, His Royal Highness Brennus and His Royal Highness Belinus, who both fought and defeated the Romans some millennia ago. My co-host for the show is, of course, Max Musson from Western Spring. It's the same with the series that we've been doing on Greatest Britons, digging up lots of information, lots of history that seems to have been lost by the wayside, and people just don't get taught it anymore. And we've got a particularly good one to get into today, I think. Somebody that two kings that every British patriot should be aware of, Brennius and Belinus, who actually defeated Rome. But before we get into that, I just want to bring up a couple of other things that I found while I was researching this, and I was looking through R.W. Morgan's The British Cymry or Britons of Cambria, Outlines of Their History and Institutions from the Earliest to the Present Time. And we've used his book before for the program we did on Boadicea and also on Caractacus. And last week we finished with the dynasty of Brutus. After that there was a series of kings, and then we got to Donald Molmutius, who wrote the Molmutine Laws. And he's referred to at the time of King Alfred the Great, who used some of his laws or built upon his laws with Alfred the Great's law book. But we don't actually have much historical proof left of Molmutine's laws. But R.W. Morgan has two pages full of them, which he takes from the Welsh Triads. And there's always been a sort of a question over how authentic the Welsh Triads actually are. But one of the laws that they had in there, I thought, was particularly interesting with what's going on today. There are three civil birthrights of every Briton: the right to go wherever he pleases, the right wherever he is to protection from his land and sovereign, and the right of equal privileges and restrictions. And when I was first reading that, I was thinking, the right to protection from the land and the sovereign, is the land and the sovereign out to get him? Because that's what it seems to be today, like the state is out to get the very people that make up the country. But no, it's saying that the sovereign needs to protect Britons wherever they are. And a Briton should be able to expect to be protected by his land and by his sovereign against any foreigner. And the right here of equal privileges and restrictions, that's been done away with hate speech laws, and where one group of people can't be punished for race hate and another group of people, they can be punished for aggravated race hate. So I just thought that was interesting. And there's another law, Molmutine law, that we'll mention later on. But I don't know if you want to comment on this law, Max, or the Molmutine laws, or anything to do with this before I continue.
No, the Molmutine laws are entirely new to me, so I will defer to you on this particular subject.
Yeah, Donald Molmutius was his name, and it was around about 600 BC, apparently, that we had this law code that was written for us. Another bit that I discovered along here was a bit of proof for how civilized Britain was and how important Britain was as a center of trade. And this is another quote from there: "No tin mines but those of Britain existed back then, nor are there any to be found now but those of Malacca, which are a comparatively recent discovery. Wherever, therefore, bronze is mentioned by the sacred or classical authors, there is evidence of the trade and manufacture of Trojan Britain." And you find mention of bronze throughout the ancient histories. But you can only make bronze with tin. And the only tin mines there were in Britain. So that shows you how Britain was connected up to everywhere that you find a mention of bronze in the classical world, which is quite a stunning
bit
of info.
That's a very interesting fact, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why I pulled it out and thought, well, I'll have to include that one. But to get into Brennius and Belinus, they were around about 400 BC. They were, in actual fact, I think they were descended from Molmutius. They were two brothers, and Belinus continued building the roads that Molmutius had started. So you can say that we had roads by around about 400 BC. We had roads in Britain. And these roads that Belinus built, they go in and out of the Roman roads. And these are the remains that you find going around the outside of the Roman roads, because the Roman roads were all straight and the British roads were a little bit more curvy. And apparently we find the traces of these roads that are still there. Well, Belinus fell out with his brother Brennus, and Brennus went to Liguria, which was northwest Italy at the time. The capital was Genoa, and he managed to get himself a wife, and he raised himself an army, and he came back to Britain to have a battle with Belinus, who was ruling Britain, and Belinus was the old one, and Brennus wanted to fight him. He wanted to take the kingship, basically, and they had the two armies, and they were lined up one against the other, just about to have this huge battle, and the mother intervened, and prevented them both from fighting one another, and they reunited. They made friends again. And then they thought, look at this army that we've got here. We've got all the Ligurians here from northwest Italy. We've got all the Britons here as well. Let's go and conquer Europe. And they set off, and they were actually the first to militarily traverse the Alps. This was before Hannibal did the same from over in Tunisia, or what is now called Tunisia. I'm forgetting the actual name of what it was there before. Carthaginia? Carthaginians?
Carthage.
Carthage, that was it. That was it. So he actually made it across the Alps before Hannibal from Carthage did. And I've got some quotes here. This first one is from Plutarch, and he says, "The greater and more warlike Cimbri," that's the Welsh, that's the Britons, "live in the northern ocean in the very ends of the earth. They are called Cimbri not from their manners, it is the name of their race. As to their courage, spirit, force, and vivacity, we can compare them only to a devouring flame. All that came before them were trodden down or driven onwards like herds of cattle." So that's praise indeed. And I've got another anecdote here from Justin. He says, "After subduing the Triboli and the Getae, the Goths, the Cimbro Celts offered their alliance in earnest to Antigonus, the king of Macedonia. Antigonus treated the offer as if it proceeded from fear or policy. 'What are these Greeks?' asked the Cimbri of their ambassadors upon their return. 'They are remarkable for two things,' replied the ambassadors. 'They call positions which have neither moats nor ramparts, camps, and they think that if they have plenty of gold, they have no need of steel.'" And again, this shows you how advanced the Britons were, and what they thought of these Greeks that thought that they would just be able to buy them off with gold. And of course, you know, they could just go in there with their steel and take the gold. And this idea of not defending your camp, it shows you that they had dug moats around the camps that they actually had in Britain. So I don't know if they had castles then, but that shows that we had moats going all the way back to then. I don't know if you want to comment on any of that, Max.
I just really had to laugh at the quotation by Plutarch: "The greater and more warlike Cimbri lived in the northern ocean at the very ends of the earth. They are called Cimbri not from their manners, it is the name of their race. As to their courage, spirit, force, and vivacity, we can compare them only to a devouring flame. All that came before them were trodden down or driven onwards like herds of cattle." It just reminded me of a scene out of Conan the Barbarian, the film with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where Conan is asked by some chieftain what happiness is. And he says, "Happiness is to crush your enemy and see the lamentation of their women." And it just conjured up that vision in my head.
Yeah, I do like these quotes and the way they put things. They're very very forthright in what they're describing here. And we can see there that the Britons, you know, they were a ferocious warlike band, but we'll also see here that they were still chivalrous, and they still had a sense of civilized behavior even when they were fighting. The Etruscans in Etruria, that's in central Italy, they were defeated in five engagements. And as they fled southwards, they torched their cities behind them. So they had a scorched earth policy. They didn't want the Britons to make use of the cities. And the following cities are enumerated by Justin and Pliny as being founded by Brennus upon the expulsion of the Etruscans: Milan, Como, Brescia, Verona, Bergamo, Mantua, Trent, and Vicentia. And I think Milan is the capital of Italy, isn't it, Max? Milan? Is that the capital of Italy?
No, Rome.
Ah, Rome is. Ah, I thought
Milan is the largest city in the north of Italy.
Largest city in the north of Italy. Well, it was what. So what this is saying is that Milan was actually founded by a British king. It was founded by Brennus, and that's on that's on the words of Justin and Pliny, who are two both well-known Roman historians. From the Cymry Celts of Cisalpine Gaul sprung many of the first writers of the Roman Empire: Livy, Pliny, Catullus, Virgil, and more. So actually a lot of these writers of the Roman Empire had British heritage. British writers state that Rome was a dependent or a tributary of Etruria, and that the king or consul of Etruria was in right of the title as consul or chief magistrate of Rome. And this account is confirmed by the Greek historians. So already at that time, by conquering the Etruscans, it meant that the Britons had the right to saying that they were the chief magistrate. They were now the chief magistrate of Rome. But the Romans wanted to fight them anyway, as we will see. And the Belgae that we hear about the Belgae being in Britain and the Belgae being this Celtic tribe that were in Gaul as well. The Belgae that the Romans wrote of were the Cymry.
After whom Belgium is named.
Ah, right. Yes, I was never sure of that, whether Belgium was named after them. So, yeah.
I've always pronounced it Belgi.
Belgi. The Belgi that the Romans wrote of were the Cymry, as the Belgi just meant war men. They were the descendants of the Cymry who conquered the country under Brennus and in Caesar's time occupied one third of Gaul. And east of them were the Teutons. And we'll hear more about the Belgi when we get, or the Belgae, when we get into Julius Caesar's invasion of Britain, because what we're going to be covering here is also each time that Britain had an encounter with Rome, because that's something that we're not told the truth about today, and it's something that we should be very proud of, in actual fact. And the Belgae played quite a big role in the politics that was going on at the time when Julius Caesar came into Britain. I don't know if you want to comment on any of those bits there about what was happening in Italy at the time, Max.
Well, just a quick one that the Cymry apparently throughout all this time they never saw anybody trying to cook a fish in a frying pan.
yes, indeed. They didn't. They never thought of putting vegetables with meat either.
Despite the fact that pescado frito is known to have been very common in Roman times in Italy as well.
Well done. Well said. Well, Brennus set up his headquarters at Mediolanum, or Myvod, or Milan, and gradually extended southwards, besieging Clusium in Lower Etruria. The inhabitants of Clusium sent to Rome for aid. Three brothers of the Fabian clan accompanied the deputation back as ambassadors. So they've gone to Rome. They said we need help, and they've come back as a diplomatic team to speak to Brennus. An interview being requested, Brennus was asked what injury had he received from the Clusians. He replied, "These Trurians have twice as much land as they can cultivate. We are powerful, numerous, and in want of land, yet they refuse to part with an acre of their useless territory." And the ambassadors replied, "But by what right do you advance such a claim?" And Brennus replied, "By the oldest of all rights, the law which pervades all nature and to which all animals are subject, the right of the strong over the weak. It is by this law these Etrurians and you Romans originally obtained your possessions. Either restore these possessions to their former owners or abide by the law yourselves." And I thought this was particularly interesting because this is the same thing that Hitler was outlining in Mein Kampf 2,500 years later with his Lebensraum, and saying that to the east of them, Russia's got all this land that is undeveloped and they need somewhere for the for the Germans to move to, and the Germans didn't have colonies. The rest of Europe had gone out and used this same law in America, in Australia, in and around the world. They used this exactly the same law, the right of the strong over the weak, to cultivate the land that was not being cultivated because they needed room for their people. And I just found it very interesting that, you know, they're talking about this same law back then as we castigate Hitler for today with his idea of Lebensraum, and the idea that we would just open up our country as we have done and allow all these people in here. Whereas 2,500 years ago, we were going out looking for land ourselves because Britain was too small for us, even at this time.
Yeah, absolutely right. And again, this sort of plays into all of the all of the whining that we get from the supposedly indigenous American peoples and the indigenous Australians, etc., about the fact that white people went out there during the colonial period and colonized their lands. That prior to white people going to the Americas, prior to the white people going to Africa and Asia, the various tribes in those countries were fighting amongst themselves and lived by the principle of might being right and the strong having the right to take possession of the lands of the weak. But they only complain about us because we were so much better at doing it than they were.
Yeah, every one of them had done exactly the same thing. It was by that law that they had taken the land themselves from the people that were there before them. And we can see here this was accepted then. Apparently today we seem to have forgotten these laws that are so obvious to us just by observing nature. Well, the next day, unfortunately, a Celtic officer was slain, and one of the slayers was recognised as being one of the Roman ambassadors, breaking the law of ambassadors carrying no weapons. Again, this shows this sense of chivalry that they had, this sense of civilization that was observed by these Celts, and it was also should have been observed by the Romans. And an embassy went to Rome and demanded Quintus Fabius be handed over. That's an embassy from the Cymry Celts. And the Senate urged compliance rather than accept dishonor upon the whole nation, but the plebeians overruled them and gave three brothers command of the army. So they said, well, we would rather fight than hand them over. But I mean, what a dishonorable thing to do. I mean, these guys are supposed to be unarmed, so that a whole of diplomacy is based around that. We still have this today when people come to our countries and they're diplomats, they can't be charged with breaking any laws because there's this sense of honor that is there. And we can see that this sense of honor went all the way back to then when you were dealing with different countries, different nations. They still had this this sense of morality, just universal laws that civilized nations would observe. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I'm just entirely in agreement with that. I was listening to what you're saying.
Well, so they started to fight one another, and Plutarch states of Brennius, his forces injured no man's property. They neither pillaged the fields nor insulted the towns. So we've got the first quote earlier, which tells us that these were really fierce warriors. But then we're told that they didn't actually damage any man's property. They just fought the Roman army. And again, that's in contrast to the Etrurians, who had the scorched earth policy and set fire to their cities behind them so that nobody could actually make use of them. And on the 6th of June, 363 BC, the Romans were routed with a great slaughter at the confluence of the little river Allia with the river Tiber. And Rome itself, with the exception of the capital, fell 3 days later into the hands of the conqueror. The anniversary of the Battle of Allia was known as the Black Day in the Roman calendar. No business was transacted, and the people would appear in mourning clothes. And you can actually look up the Battle of Allia on Wikipedia, and it's got a lot of detail about it, but it doesn't tell you that the guy that was leading this was actually a British king, and it was an alliance between the Ligurians and the British and the Cymru. But it does have a lot of details there. It's very well recorded because this was a great ignominy for Rome to actually have lost this battle. The capital withstood a siege of 6 months, and during this time, Fabius Dorso was still able to regularly proceed in his pontifical robes to make sacrifices on his particular clan day at the Quirinal Hill. The Roman writers expressed surprise that he was allowed to do this and return in safety, but the Cymry would have sooner thought of striking their own sovereign as they would have unsheathed a weapon in front of a priest or the head of a clan. In making way for him and escorting him back to the capital, they were just observing their own British customs. So again, we got records of how civilized the British were. And this is something that we've mentioned again before about how the battles would stop at certain times and you'd be able to go out and get the people in. They would stop on Sundays. They would stop at tea time. They would exchange ambassadors. They had all these rules of war that they had. And obviously the British had a lot of respect for religion. So they respected the fact that this Fabius Dorso wanted to go and make his sacrifices. So they actually protected him on his way back to make certain that he was able to make his way back in safety and that he was allowed to do this. And the Romans were surprised at that. Again, it shows you this sense of the superiority of the British people, I guess it shows.
What it shows basically is that warfare in those days was regarded not as total war in the way that it is nowadays, where it's an entire nation pitching itself against another entire nation, but it was a series of contests between the professional fighting men that have been assembled by aristocrats, effectively. So you had an aristocratic class who ruled the society beneath it, the feudal society that would have existed beneath them. And that would have provided their wealth, but the aristocratic class claimed and had the right to rule the feudal peoples based upon the fighting prowess of their professional fighting men that they maintained.
Yeah,
the wars were just between the professional fighting men and not wars against the actual people themselves.
Yeah, that's an important point. They were employing these people to do this. They weren't, the whole country had to leave. It was the fighting men from the army that Brennus had raised in Liguria and that Belinus had raised in Britain. And they left people in their country behind, the townsfolk and all the rest of them. And it was just soldiers here, professional soldiers. It's probably why they won. After a second victory from Brennius, when the Porcina of Etruria tried to attack, the Romans agreed to ransom the capital for 1,000 pounds weight in gold. When the gold was being weighed, Brennus threw his sword and belt into the opposite scale, and when asked what means this act, he said, "It means woe to the vanquished." And I think that's quite a famous quote, that it means woe to the vanquished. It means you've lost, so you can't say anything about it. And again, this is the same thing that happened with this unconditional surrender, really, with Germany, and they couldn't say anything about it because it was an unconditional surrender. And we've got a similar thing here, but no way near as bad, obviously. But they'd made the deal, and Brennus threw his sword and his belt into the opposite scale, and so that means woe to the vanquished. The gold was transferred to Narbonne in Gaul, and Brennus withdrew his troops and shortly after concluded an alliance with Dionysius of Sicily. The once accepted account of the recovery of the gold and the defeat of Brennius by Camillus is now abandoned by all scholars as a fiction of Roman vanity. Rome indeed only came into the province of history after her capture by the Cymry. So I find that interesting as well. So, you know, this was such an important thing that Rome decided to cover it up with some propaganda and pretend that they actually got the gold back. But that's accepted today as being a falsehood. I've got a description here of what they actually look like. Virgil, and again, I mentioned Virgil in the last one of the last episodes we did, he was a historian from the 16th century, very, very well respected. He's still well respected today. And he describes the uniform and arms of the conquerors of Rome. He says their vest was a mass of golden lace. They wore the golden torque around their necks, a sword by their side. Two javelins with heavy steel heads were their principal missiles. Oblong shields borne on their shoulders during a march covered their whole bodies in action. And this was in 400 BC. So they were well equipped for battle, basically, and the Britons won, and won lots of gold out of it as well. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Well, this description is again consistent with, you know, what I was saying about the armies, the people actually took part in the fighting, that took an active part in it, of them being professional soldiers who would have almost been a breed apart from the common people in terms of the fact that they would have been people who would have been trained in martial techniques throughout their whole lives. They probably would be people who would have been raised as fighters and who would have provided a professional fighting class from which armies were recruited by aristocrats in those days.
And we'll also see that keeping hold of your weapons was very important as well in the next episode, where we have somebody that loses their shield, which was considered to be quite an ignominious action to actually lose your shield. Well, after conquering Rome, Brennus reigned for 30 years in northern Italy, and the Cumro-Celtic kingdom there was henceforth known as Cisalpine Gaul, and its people were the first to be admitted to the full rights of Roman citizenship. Again, this shows us that Europeans all come originally from the same tribes in the first place. You know, when they will say, well, the Romans came over to Britain and invaded Britain, we should allow immigration. Well, these Romans were the same people. And we can see here that the Britons were the same people as the Ligurians, and they were the people that ended up being called the Belgae. They ended up people in Gaul. It was all the same people. They just had different cultures. It was the same genes that were shared between them. So we had Brennus. He reigned for 30 years in northern Italy. Belinus divided his territories in Gaul between his five sons and returned to Britain, where he built Belling's Castle, which is now called Billingsgate, and the stupendous embankments of the Thames were begun and finished under him. And again, because on their way to the Alps and on their way to Rome, they had lots of battles in Gaul and took lots of places, but I didn't want to get too into that. I just wanted to concentrate on Rome today. And from that time, there was a long peace in Britain that lasted right up until about 50 years before the Julian invasion of Britain, which we'll get into next week. But I also, having a look on Wikipedia, they say Rome was indeed captured by Brennus, a Gaulish chieftain, following the Battle of the Allia on the 18th of July, 390 BC. And the Porcina of Etruria are named after a king of the Etruscan civilization who is believed to have fought against the recently founded Roman Republic in the decade of the 500s BC. So that's where we see that that little bit there about that I referred to earlier about how the Greek writers say that Rome was a tributary of the Etruscans at this time. That would have been then. That would have been the Porcina of Etruria. He was the king of the Etruscan civilization, and he was the one that tried to start a battle, as we heard earlier, the Porcina of Etruria. So that there's your evidence for this. But they will try and say today that Brennus was Gaulish. He was from Gaul, but our records in Britain state that he was a British king, and and as we see, there are, you know, that's why they're talking about the Cymry. And these are the people that ended up peopling Europe. And I guess
it's amazing. It's amazing the involvement of British tribes and British tribal leaders and British kings in the affairs of the proto-European states, because, you know, a lot of these areas that they would have marched through, etc., would have just been small principalities before the unifications of the countries involved, but it is amazing the degree of involvement that there was.
And the diplomacy that they had and the relations that they had with the continent. I mean, Britain was this island. It was at the far reaches of the earth. But as we could see with the tin mines, it was connected up right the way to the Near East, the Middle East, all across the known world. And as they were heading to Rome to make this battle against Rome, and they were conquering parts of Gaul, they would have picked up people from these Gaulish tribes that then travelled with them as well, the soldiers that were there. They would have joined up with them. Once they'd been defeated, they would have joined with them and made this march upon Rome. I find it really fascinating stuff to learn about. And this was our first encounter with Rome, and we defeated them. And Nobody knows about it today. Nobody knows about this great achievement of the ancient Britons. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear more about our greatest Britons, then we produce that in the second half of our Real Britannia podcast here at Radio Albion that we produce every Monday. Or you can wait until all these separate parts are edited together into one show like the one you have just heard.